Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move.
By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter.
Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice.
Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Welcome to another Daily Tech News Show special edition. I'm Tom Merritt, and joining me today, I'm very happy to be talking with Josh Leposky, professor of geography at Memorial University. Josh, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Not at all. Thank you, Tom.
We are going to talk about e-waste. And before we get into what it is and the background of it, how did you get into studying this?
I've been interested in high tech, digital tech for a really long time, ever really since my undergrad. And actually, it all started when someone handed me William Gibson's famous novel, Neuromancer, back in the early 90s. And I guess it's one of those instances where, I can really say, a book changed my life. I was just, for whatever reason, fascinated by the world that was being described in that book and starting to see bits and pieces of it, kind of emerge around me as the internet was becoming more mainstream and, people were getting this crazy thing called email and all of that. And from that kind of very early interest, I was interested in the kind of environmental scenes that were in that book and starting to think about, the novel is describing a world that in some ways looks a little dark. Is that where we're headed? And that turned into a whole variety of projects, including much later on field work in Southeast Asia. And then for my PhD, and then later on post PhD into the specific topic of waste from electronics.
How does geography fit into the study of e-waste?
Yeah, it's crucial. In some of the ways are quite basic. Like so many economic activities, there's a different cost to do business in different places. And depending on what the specific business in mind is, those costs are going to be different. geography plays a critical role in terms of, for example, just something as basic as the cost of transportation of getting stuff, in this case, scrap electronics, from where they're collected to where they're going to be processed. And that has might sound, sort of like a simple proposition on the surface, but actually processing scrap from electronics and all of the materials involved in that requires, or can require very specialized industrial equipment, and that equipment doesn't exist everywhere. It has to go to certain places for that processing. So that's sort of the basic sense in which geography really matters.
In the wide scope of human history, e-waste is relatively new. In fact, waste management itself, when you think about it, is kind of new. We just used to throw stuff in the river, right? Or
right.
Outside the town.
Yeah.
Give us a little sense of when e-waste started to become a thing that had to be dealt with on its own and how we've got to where we are now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so it's an interesting history. So some of the earliest references I've been able to find go back to the early 70s, actually, but in ways that are quite different than how we currently think about e-waste. So in the early 70s, the U.S. Bureau of Mines was actually actively exploring scrap electronics as sources of precious and semi-precious metals. But at that point, the concern was really about sort of growing resource scarcity, as opposed to, say, a waste management problem or, you know, sort of allied concerns around what comes along with waste or e-waste specifically, like toxicity or pollution. So the issues were quite different, even though the specific sources that they were looking at were similar or the same. You jump forward really to the very late 90s. You start seeing a few reports coming out of Europe as they were starting to have some concerns about more and more of post-consumer electronics entering the municipal solid waste stream and sort of presenting you know, new challenges for that existing infrastructure. Some early then business journalism in and around 2000, when brand manufacturers were meaning brands like HP and whatnot, were starting to see or understand that they had a particular issue around dealing with end of life electronics. And at that point, the conversation really was much different than that history from the early 70s. Now the conversation was, look, this is potentially an issue because there's, depending on how things are processed, materials can release a lot of toxicants. So we need to manage this material in a responsible way. And then I think really there was a watershed moment with a report that came from an environmental NGO, the Basel Action Network, in 2002, which called Exporting Harm. And that report detailed through some interviews and photography and whatnot, what is now kind of the classic image of e-waste that has labels on it indicating or brand marks indicating that it came from wealthier markets, you know, U.S., Canada, Western Europe, and ending up in the so-called developing world. Initially in China, but then some of their work showing elsewhere as well. At that point, e-waste becomes it becomes more than just a story about proper waste management. It really, and this is one of the reasons I'm so interested in it, is that these technologies and the wastes that arise from it really start to become, you know, almost allegorical stories, you know, ways of telling much, much broader stories about, you know, on the one hand, sort of technological progress, and on the other hand, and the sort of utopic images that go through that, and then on the other hand, sort of much more dystopic, real almost end of the world type stories, and somehow. Well, not somehow. I mean, electronics comes to stand in as the sort of the technology of the moment to narrate those stories. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The visions of the mountains of, you know, dead circuit boards and all of that sort of looming over us for sure. Tells a story of itself.
That's right. I mean, just very quickly to make a quick historical point about that, a lot of that discourse around e-waste today has some really interesting similarities to the same kinds of stories that were being told through scrap automobiles in the early 20th century in the U.S. and then right through into the 1970s, where it was the car and it's the sort of the scrap heap was sort of a stand-in for you know, the dark side of, right. of progress in the U.S. So, yeah.
Yeah, I wonder why we're not seeing more movies with shady characters meeting in electronic scrapyards. It seems like that would make sense.
Right. Well, funny you should mention that. There is actually a James Bond novel, relatively recent. I forget the name of it, but where the villain is, in fact, an electronic scrap recycler. And he's, you know, the equivalent of Spectre, whatever, making his money from getting the data from harvesting the data from scrapped electronics. So,
oh, wow. Yeah. Well, Mr. Bond, I expect you to just toss it over there in that heap.
That's right. Exactly.
Well, so, I'm sure there are people out there in the audience who have secretly thrown a wire or two or maybe even a whole device in the trash and hoped that no one would find out. There are plenty of people I know responsibly take their devices to a recycling center or drop-off point at an electronics store, something like that. That's what we know from, you know, the day-to-day. And how is e-waste generally being handled around the world now?
Yeah, so generally it's handled as you say, as a post-consumer waste stream. We can get into why that's important if you want, a little later on. But, if I had to talk about sort of two broad general patterns, these materials are either they're entering municipal solid waste systems, waste management systems that are sort of formalized curbside kind of pickup situations, in which case they may, depending on the specific location we're talking about, would be, you know, those materials would then either go to landfill if that's permitted, or they would be routed into a recycling recycling system. If they move into a recycling system, they're not going into landfill, but they then enter a highly industrialized sort of big industry sort of process, where the basic way things happen is that whole devices are shredded, destroyed, broken down into their constituent materials. Broadly speaking, that's going to be metals, plastics, and glass, or glasses, plural. And then those materials go through a set of sorting processes to try and get them into as pure a fraction of the material as possible. So, for example, separating the ferrous from non-ferrous materials. So separating, say, copper and aluminum from iron and steel, trying to separate the different plastics, which is extremely challenging, as well as separating the glasses. And then once that separation the separation process is complete, or it is considered complete, when the company handling that material can then sell it back on to basically the world market for commodities. So in many ways, big industrial recycling companies they're very similar to mining companies in a lot of ways, because they are often selling their material back into the same markets that, you know, buyers for whatever manufacturing sector, electronics, automobiles, what have you, are sourcing metals, plastics, and glasses.
Does that include the rare earths that are often a topic of controversy?
That's very that's harder to say. Rare earths are actually very common, despite their name. But one of the things that makes them tricky is that they are very diffusely distributed around the planet. So it's not that they're hard to find, it's that finding them in significant enough concentrations is tricky. And once those materials are in things like electronics, depending on the specific rare earth material you're talking about, they are more or less easy to recover. And right now, recovery of rare earths is still technically, recovery of rare earths in a recycling process is still technically quite difficult. Mm-hmm. So it's not that it's not being done, but it's much, much, much harder to do than other common materials like copper or aluminum, steel, that kind of thing.
Got it. Now, yeah. if I throw my phone, which no one should do, but if I throw my old phone into the trash bin, is there usually a process to recover that, or does that mean it's just going to end up right in the landfill and not get recycled?
Yeah. Again, it depends where specifically you're doing that. Even within the U.S., there will be differences from city to city, because, you know, once this is part of the issue with handling really any waste material, but certainly e-waste, is once you're dealing with curbside pickup, there's so many differences between the systems from city to city that it can depend a lot. Most or many cities, as part of curbside pickup, will send material through what's called a materials recovery facility, an MRF or a MRF, as they say in the industry. And again, depending on the system, there may be processes at those facilities to separate out electronics from other municipal solid waste, but not always. Mm-hmm. And that process will be, you know, more or less automated, despite, you know, what we might think about, you know, the promise of things like artificial intelligence and automation and all of this. Something as seemingly simple as sorting materials for recycling is actually, even though the work tends to be very low paid, is actually highly skilled. And just to give you an example of that, some recycling facilities are trying to automate sorting of plastics. They will do what's called optical sorting, which involves using lasers that basically, you know, as material goes by on a conveyor belt, you're shining a laser on it, and the computer reads, you know, the reflectivity of the material going by. Mm. And different plastics have different reflectivities, and so it allows some automated sorting. Except when it comes to black plastics, which because of their color, they can mess up they can make it difficult to reflect back, and make it difficult to sort by that automated process. One of the consequences of that is that black plastics, which are very common in electronics and many other goods as well, their color is similar to the eye, but they have very different underlying chemistries, or can have very different underlying chemistries. And what that messing up of the optical sorting means often is that black plastics that are used in electronics that have toxic flame retardants in them end up getting mingled with other black plastics that were originally used in things like food packaging or, you know, cutlery, that kind of thing. And so you have the mingling together then of plastic streams that then you and I get back as recycled goods that, you know, we may or may not want to be eating or having our food packaged with them.
Yeah, I don't want my soda. No, I don't drink a lot of soda, but I don't want any can of anything or bottle to have flame retardant plastic in it. Yeah.
Right.
So I know that probably a question a lot of people have in the audience would be, is it still the case that most of the developed countries are pushing out their waste to developing countries to have that recycling done, or is that shifted now?
Yeah, it's shifting quite a lot. It's really actually a question, the extent to which that was ever really the case. So what my research and some research from other folks is showing is that the largest or the biggest reason for export in the past has been, well, and to today, is for the market for the reuse of devices that get discarded in richer markets.
Okay.
Discarded not because they're necessarily broken, They might be, but they're discarded, and people in richer markets are able to afford a new device, so they go out and get it. Meanwhile, importers overseas see a huge opportunity to bring in quite very cheap devices then for repair and reuse. It's not that none of the export that was going on was for export for materials recovery or recycling. But even those early images that are sort of framed as e-waste dumping, what has yet to really ever be sufficiently explained is the real cost difference to ship waste from, say, the U.S. to then just put it straight in a dump overseas, and when it's typically cheaper to just send it to landfill in the U.S. So the person who pays the shipping cost in these cases is the overseas buyer. So the equivalent here would be, why would you go online to Amazon and buy a book, and then the book arrives, you pay for the shipping, and then you put it in the garbage.
Right.
It the economics just don't really make sense. The other big issue that is only now sort of being recognized is just how much of that equipment that was appearing in some of those early reports was also coming from domestic sources overseas. Mm-hmm. We might have these sort of cartoonish images of the so-called developing world or third world, as if computers are, some kind of imported magic that they've never seen before. Mm-hmm. These images still persist. And yet, of course there are banking sectors and, medical industries and all of the, post-secondary institutions that have been using high tech for decades and decades. Television, radio have been, in place in these countries for 20, 30 years, if not longer.
Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move.
By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter.
Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice.
Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model in the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
So your question is that still happening? The picture has now, it is changing in part. You've probably heard this as, China brought in a variety of trade bans for what China calls foreign garbage. But prior to say a year or a year and a half ago was, what the industry calls scrap. That gets complicated in that those trade bans from China have been for materials that don't encompass the sort of full gamut of electronic waste. And there's been no explicit ban from China or other countries recently specifically about electronic waste. They have banned particular kinds of plastics, some of which are relevant to electronics, but it can then depend on, you know, is the material coming as whole devices versus shredded material and whatnot. So the landscape of recycling materials recovery around electronics, it is changing, and it's changing very quickly recently, but it's also quite a complicated landscape.
It seems, though, and this may be oversimplifying it a bit, but it seems that the main driving factor is being able to sell whatever materials you can recover from it back into the marketplace.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, when it comes to the recycling market, yes, I think, you know, it's helpful to think of recycling as a materials recovery market, and in that sense, it's quite similar to traditional mining. It's about getting materials that can be sold into a manufacturing process. But as I say, there's sort of two broad streams that relate to exports from richer markets. One stream is the material recoveries market, which is in terms of value much sort of less an issue than the reuse stream, which has historically been much more valuable in terms of, as I say, getting cheap or free discarded devices in richer markets, bringing them to poorer markets overseas and selling them into the reuse market.
That would seem to be when you trade in your phone, right? Is that often the source of those kinds of devices?
There is some of that. That's difficult to track. In the trade-in industry, industry is the way to describe it. You know, a lot of those companies, say T-Mobile or Verizon, what have you, they have contractual agreements with the brand manufacturers of the phones, say Samsung or Apple or Huawei, etc. And those brand manufacturers are working quite hard to recover the value of those phones as phones in the used market. And that can be, those used markets are, some of that is overseas, but a lot of it is also domestic to the US or Canada or Western Europe as well. So that's what you're talking there about, the trade-in market is quite different than, say, what happens to your phone if it goes into the curbside collection system.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then is a lot of the materials recovery done domestically in countries versus being exported?
In the U.S., no. a sort of basic, what I guess I would call kind of pre-processing is done. And what that really is just shredding. Mm-hmm. And then some of that sorting into different fractions, material fractions, as the industry would say. Again, the metals, the plastics, the glasses. Some of that is done domestically in the U.S. or Canada or in Europe, but a lot of the final processing prior to getting sold into the manufacturing markets is also done overseas. I mean, it's certainly some of that is done in China, but that is also where things are manufactured as new devices.
It makes sense to recover the materials close to where the materials might be needed. And
that's right.
Yeah.
There's more we can get into on that front if you like. I mean, I just very quickly can say that historically, it wasn't always the case. There was quite a bit of recycling infrastructure in the United States, but over time, kind of along with the globalization of manufacturing, so too the globalization of recycling and the infrastructure that goes with it. Good portions of the recycling infrastructure in the U.S. also moved overseas. And sort of interestingly, with the current bans that China has imposed on receiving what they are calling foreign garbage, one of the ways that Chinese firms that had been processing that material are, I'll say getting around it, but I don't mean anything nefarious. Mm-hmm. They're starting to buy up U.S. recycling infrastructure and moving their operations, as it were, or parts of them back to the U.S. It's sort of analogous to what happened, in the late 70s and 80s with the U.S. Car industry, where, in order to get around trade tariffs, Honda, Toyota, and whatnot started building manufacturing plants in the United States. It's similar to that.
Interesting. Before we do wrap up here, I want to ask, I know we've touched on a lot of the implications that this has on us as consumers. What are some of the other things that e-waste handling, the way it impacts us, that maybe we don't think about or don't see?
Yeah. I mean, to me, the biggest issue in terms for us as consumers or citizens is how the framing of e-waste as strictly a post-consumer issue is actually part of the problem. Mm-hmm. Because left out of the conversation then, deliberately or not, is all of the waste that occurs even before you and I buy our devices in manufacturing. And the pollution and waste arising in electronics manufacturing far exceeds, what arises as post-consumer e-waste when it reaches, say, a municipal solid waste system. And, that's a problem in all sorts of ways, in part that all of the concern around e-waste, whether it's to be regulated in this way or that way, focuses on the end of the pipe and doesn't do anything really to change what's coming down the pipe in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, I think it's how e-waste has been framed is one of the most important implications of it as a waste problem in its sort of the current concern around it. I think we really need to sort of turn the camera around, as it were, and look upstream and be thinking hard about ways to change the chemical makeup of the products that are coming down the pipe that we will eventually buy.
So not just the waste that is made in the manufacturer, although it sounds like that's a part of it, but also making products that contribute less waste at the end of their life?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that covers less waste at end of life covers, a range of options there, longer durability, more repairability, mm-hmm. Even just easier to recycle. One of the issues is that contemporary electronics are materially very complicated or very complex, and that industrial materials recovery process I described, the shredding and the sorting, the more chemically complex a device is, the harder and harder that materials management is at end of life. There's that aspect of things. There's also sort of I guess I would call it a kind of an environmental justice issue here, in that the people dealing with these devices at end of life, even when they're in proper, as it were, proper facilities in the U.S. and Canada, even with all the safety precautions that are taken, they're still, and there's good research backing this up, they're still exposed to toxicant levels that are problematic. And that, recycling will never change that. Recycling is about dealing with waste after it exists. That means it's already got a chemical makeup.
Right.
and all of that kind of stuff. So we need to change how things are made before they become waste in the first place.
And I know this is an oversimplification, but it does feel like the more repairable a phone or a computer is, the easier it would be to recover materials from it.
Yeah, I think that's possible. I think it depends on a variety of factors. Mm-hmm. But yes, generally speaking, I think if something is simple to repair, it probably is also simple or simpler to recycle.
Right. Not that there aren't other issues as far as the materials used in the boards and things like that, too.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Well, Professor Leposky, thank you so much for chatting with us today. I know there's way more there is to this topic, obviously, than we could cover in a half hour. If folks want to find out more about this topic, about the work that you do, where should they go?
Well, they can follow me on Twitter at @rubbishmaker. They can go to the website. Electronicplanet.xyz.
Excellent. That's a Z for you Americans.
Oh, yes, that's right. No my Canadian roots.
Josh, thank you so much for talking with us again. Really appreciate it.
Not at all. Thank you, Tom. It was a pleasure.
If you want to keep these kinds of interviews and Daily Tech News Show coming, of course, you'll want to support us at patreon.com/DTNS. That is where we get most of the funding we use to make the show happen. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move.
By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter.
Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice.
Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.